Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to Weavecast. This is episode 52, Kathy Roig. This episode, we bring you an interview with Kathy Roig, a talented weaver who's known for her painted warps. And by this, I don't mean that she just paints color onto warps, but she actually paints imagery. And so when the fabric is woven up, it has this wonderful watercolor appearance. They are just stunning. The audio for this interview was recorded and produced by Nancy Smith Kilkenny. Nancy always does a marvelous job, and we are so fortunate to have her here on the show. After the interview, I will come back with a brief audio essay, When to Weave with the Good Stuff. This is an issue that came up recently in a class, and I just want to share some of my thoughts about when you're ready to weave with the good yarn. Before we head off into the interview, I would like to tell you about the Weavecast summer hiatus. This summer, Weavecast will be closing production for June, July, and August. Right now, you're listening to the May episode, and the next one will come back in September. There are a couple of pieces that are being produced by ensemble members, and if those come in, those may be posted during the summer, but I will be taking the summer off. There is a lot going on in my family this summer, and they need me. So I'm going to take the summer off, and then I will come back in September. Now, my family's asked me to keep some of this stuff private, but I can tell you that most of it is quite delightful, happy stuff that has a lot of work associated with it. And there is one sad thing. I will see you in September, and I hope that you have a wonderful, joyous, happy summer. If you're going to Convergence, have a wonderful, wonderful time.
I want to welcome Kathy Roig to Weavecast today. Kathy is in the midst of teaching Warp It, Paint It, Weave It, which is a workshop about designing fabric by using painted warps. We're so pleased she could travel to Northeast Ohio from her home in North Carolina to join us this weekend. Welcome back to the Buckeye State.
Thank you.
I know that you have roots back here.
So I do, and nice. It's great to see a lot of old friends.
Our main point in talking to you today, Kathy, is to find out about your evolution as a hand weaver and why warp painting has become a big part of your artistic focus. But first of all, tell me about how you were drawn into weaving. What was the spark or the opportunity that brought you to weaving?
Well, it has always been a bit of an evolution, I guess I would say. I loved to make things as a kid. I sewed clothes for my Barbie dolls, for myself. I ended up getting my college degree in visual arts from a small liberal arts school in Ohio. And then I got married, and my husband bought me a small table loom as a wedding present. And that came along with a lesson on how to prepare it and how to weave on it, and I fell in love with it. We then moved to Indiana, and I wasn't sure what I was going to be doing there, but there happened to be a wonderful weaving shop there and had classes and a very active weaving guild. And I got involved with that group, met a lot of wonderful weavers. And one in particular was a professional weaver, and I ended up working for her for about a year. So I learned a lot of the basics of weaving from her. We then moved back to the Cleveland area, and I started weaving more on my own. So it was mostly, like, you know, self-taught as much as anything, workshops here and there. And it's just kind of evolved as my life has. I had a child and didn't do as much weaving at that point, but it has always been, you know, my profession, I guess I'd say, selling things, but also having it as a way to express myself.
Now, I know you got your bachelor's from Otterbein College, which is near the Columbus area. If you didn't get your visual art degree in weaving, which it doesn't sound like you did, what was it in, and did it help inform your weaving when you did get started in this?
Yeah, the visual arts degree was just a basic art degree. There was actually no weaving involved. I did a little clay. I did some photography. But the majority of my time I had was painting. And I did some drawing. Drawing was not easy for me to do. But the painting, I could put color down, and it didn't have to necessarily represent anything. It was usually based on representation, but I found I really enjoyed working with paint and the color.
Now, you have a career in the fiber arts. How did you go from weaving as a craft, if you will, or as a hobby, to turning it into a source of income and a career?
Again, it's a bit of an evolution, I guess I'd say. You know, you start weaving and you already, all your family members have towels and blankets and scarves, and you're still weaving and, you know, you have a lot of items. So I started doing some craft fairs, and I did clothing actually at that time. And I did a few art fairs in the Cleveland area, and Lakewood and Cleveland Heights in Bay Village. And it really, I loved being able to make things that people wanted to buy. I mean, it really is kind of a nice feeling. And so that kind of led to finding other locations to sell my work, other shops and galleries. I'd say once my son reached high school, I got a studio. Well, actually, he was maybe in middle school, I got a studio outside my home. And I think it was kind of at that point for me, having a studio outside my home, you know, something changed a little bit on how I approached my work. It could really separate from what I was doing at home. And I had studios where folks could come in and see me work too. And I enjoyed that part. And if they bought things from me too, that was nice too. So now that my son is now off to college, these last 4 years since I've moved to North Carolina, it has been indeed a full-time job, and I've gotten more work to sell, more shops and galleries to have my work at, and some commissioned work as well.
You mentioned that you're living in North Carolina in the Asheville area. You operate a retail space, and you have an internet Etsy shop. Talk about what you sell and how the art business has been faring in this economy, but also what kind of community Asheville is to work in as an artist.
Well, it's been wonderful, you know, in one word, but I certainly, yeah, my studio is in a location called Riverwood Shops, and there are other craftspeople that have a working studio and a retail spot all in one place. So folks come and they can see a stained glass artist work and his finished product. There's a potter and a jeweler and myself. And we all welcome people to see us work and buy items out of our gallery or shop. So the things that I sell, I do mostly household items, placemats, dish towels. I do tote bags and some baby items. I have a baby bibs that I do, and baby blankets. They're all quite functional and meant to be used daily. And I really try hard to make the items not only beautiful, but quite useful and sturdy and durable.
You also take commissions. So talk about some of the pieces that are more artistic. They're wall hangings. They're there are things that take a different kind of artistic interpretation. And how long you've been doing that?
Yeah, so the wall pieces I do have really been a little bit more personal in expression, and not with the intent that someone might buy them, that they would match their couch necessarily or a pillow or whatever, although some have sold, but that's not necessarily the intent. The intent has been an idea I have, or maybe even a technique that I want to try. So it does offer me some more way to express myself. From those, I have gotten some commissioned work that, although are unique and expressive, do require me to work within some guidelines of what the commission is. One in particular is at St. Bonaventure University, and they wanted me to depict a scene in Italy, and they gave me a photograph of a mountain, and I had to interpret it in my media of weaving, and I did some painting on the warp, and so although it needed to represent the image that they wanted, I was still able to interpret it in my unique way, I guess. The other commission piece that I just finished this past fall was a four-panel piece, and I worked with an art consultant who in turn worked with a hospital that this commission piece was going to be installed. And we spent several months actually going back and forth on what the image, the size, the color. They needed to know pretty much what the final piece was going to look like. So again, although it was pretty much my expression and my interpretation, I did have to follow some guidelines on what they wanted. And I actually kind of enjoyed that. They were quite willing to work with what I could do. And so it depicts a mountain scene where I live now, and each panel is a different season. And that piece is installed at the North Carolina Cancer Center in Chapel Hill.
I've noticed also that with the pieces that are not necessarily commissions, but they're wall pieces, they're artistic interpretations, you have a name for all those pieces. It's very specific. And it seems to me that you're very thoughtful about what inspires you, how you're going to place that in a weaving. And I kind of wonder, where do you draw a lot of your inspiration from? What seems to move you to do these specific pieces? And again, I just love the fact that you've got a specific name for everything.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, not that I'm unique, but many times nature is an inspiration for artists, and that is indeed where I gather a lot of my inspiration. And so the names, the titles of these pieces are connected in some way to nature. And then I look at either the surroundings around me or images from magazines or postcards, or sometimes there's a direct connection between the landscape. Sometimes there's just an image of a landscape that I'm drawn to. And I've found lately, actually, that trees seem to be this recurring theme. And sometimes I don't know what has been the inspiration until I kind of look back and see what I've done.
There's one piece, though, in particular, though, that had to do with an event, and it was 9/11. And I'd like you to explain that piece and what did you connect with on that, and how special is that to you?
Yeah. After 9/11, I read an article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer by an editorialist, Regina Brett, and she had written an editorial about how the world had changed. And indeed it has. And we still feel that now, I think. But she also mentioned that perhaps a good way to deal with this or just kind of get through the day is to take a walk out in nature and look at the trees and the leaves, because no one told the leaves that the world had changed. And it really struck me that that's how I wanted to approach how I was going to deal with this. So those words, no one told the leaves, I just loved those words. And so I wove a piece called No One Told the Leaves. And a loom that I work on almost exclusively for my wall pieces is called a draw loom. And basically it allows me to weave anything that I can put on graph paper. So I took my handwriting and wrote the words, No One Told the Leaves. And I put it on graph paper. Basically, I enlarged it and put it on graph paper and wove those words in the center of this wall piece. And I also removed color from the yarn that I was going to use, and it ended up being kind of this smoky gray softness that somehow made me think of that event. So that piece, was definitely the most expressive piece that I've done, and it still is emotional to me.
And where do you have that hanging? Is that in an institution, or is it in your home? Do you get to see it a lot?
That's in my studio, and I see it every day. And it is the only thing that's not for sale ever. And I like to have it in my studio. As I mentioned, folks get to come in and see me work. It's not kind of front and center in my studio. It's against kind of a back wall, although it's not hidden from view. But it is, and I have a little written description of that piece and how it inspired me, written next to it so that folks can see it if they're so inclined. And, you know, some folks are pulled into it and others not. It doesn't matter, but I do get to see it every day. And sometimes I will point it out to folks if we get into that type of conversation.
You talked about the draw loom. You've talked about that a lot this weekend because many of us don't really understand how they work. And I'm not going to ask you to explain that. But why do you work on the draw loom? And you've kind of talked about that a little bit already. But why is that the loom that pulled you in to say, hey, this is the type of loom that I want to work on? And how is it able to help you create everything that you want to create?
Well, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. Weaving is such a grid-like structure. The fabric is, you know, very grid-like, and sometimes you might feel you can't do or create the design that you particularly want because you're limited by what the loom can do or not do. And I think I'd always... even though I love the structure of weaving, I think there was always a part of me that kind of wanted to break away a little bit from that and find a way to express myself and make it uniquely mine and what I wanted to do. And when I saw a friend of mine weave on one of these and she let me weave on hers, I could really see a lot of possibilities. So you know, it didn't take long for me to think, okay, I need to have one of these. And it has been quite a journey, I guess I'd say, to have this loom be a part of the weaving that I do. I started doing pieces that kind of related to when my son was little. We looked at a lot of children's books with bright colors and real graphic designs, and I used a lot of that in some of the earlier pieces when I got my draw loom.
Maybe you should just really briefly explain, just to give people an idea that don't know, what is it that sets a draw loom apart? Just a general explanation, because it can be a little confusing.
Yeah. It has two sets of shafts. So it's a double harness loom, and there's cords that are above me that are connected to the second set of heddles. And those are the design or the pattern heddles. And they sit behind the structure heddles. So I pull or draw these cords according to this graph paper that I have put my design on, whether it's lettering or an animal or even, you know, squares or circles. By pulling those cords, it raises an area of the warp. And then when I weave, that area becomes more predominant. And I use a four-shaft broken twill structure. You're not limited to that type of structure. There's other twills that can be used. This is just what I have chosen to use.
Now, let's get into painted warps a little bit. I don't think you have to have a draw loom to do painted warps, but you can use it probably in conjunction with it. But it's grown very popular over the last few years. What has drawn you to that type of expression in your art, and why do you love it so much? It's become part of your teaching schedule.
You don't need a draw loom to do a painted warp. In fact, I've got 10 weavers out there weaving on table looms and small little looms, doing a beautiful job of painted warps. I'll first make clear that I am using fabric paints, not dyes. That is something that I stress. I think that's about the first or second sentence I say now when I start teaching this class. For me, the paints are much more immediate, more direct, and there's less chemical steps involved. And I do love to dye, actually, as well, and I have done some dyeing. But sometimes I felt I had just wanted to add a little bit of color here and there. And I think as I look at my pieces over the years that I've used this process, I see that I'm adding more paint to pieces as I go along. I think it has to do again with kind of breaking out of that grid a little bit, and putting color where I want it. I've played around with watercolor paints a lot, and maybe it goes back to my college painting days too. So working with color is quite exciting for me as well. So it's just another way that I can add some color, and in a fairly easy way.
We've been learning on the loom war painting and off the loom painting, and besides the obvious, what is the difference? How do you, what do you think the difference is in terms of the way that you design your painted warps, depending on which way you're going to do it?
Well, on loom painting, I mean, the way I've been doing it and teaching it is to just paint the section that's right in front of you that you're getting ready to weave, but you haven't woven yet. So you paint that little bit, dry it, weave that, and then you advance your warp. And so you're just working in these little sections. So it's a little trickier if you want one whole piece of fabric to kind of have not cohesiveness, but you're working just bits at a time. The off-loom painting I describe and explain by spreading it out on table where your whole length and width of your warp is directly in front of you, and you can work easier with a cartoon underneath. So you might have a better idea. It might be easier for you to put the colors where you want on the whole piece of fabric.
Now, I know that you're a member of that well-respected group, the Southern Highland Craft Guild, and this is just not the kind of guild that people would typically think of because it's more professional. But I've always wondered how it works, and if you could just kind of explain the guild, their mission, why they were set up, and I think that there's kind of a deep history there too, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, actually. It's one of the first things I wanted to accomplish when I got to North Carolina. I'd heard about the guild, and actually I knew a weaver in the area before we moved down there, and she said, oh, you just have to enter this, and, you know, don't worry about it. And I did worry about it a little, but it's a pretty rigorous juring process. You have to submit, I won't know the details too much, but maybe four or five photographic images, and you have to fill out a fairly extensive entry form, not only kind of your background, but also why you're doing this work, what's the body of work mean, you know, a lot of more detail than just, you know, it's cotton yarn and it's some sort of weave structure. So once you get through that process, if you get through that process, then the second process is you bring actual items to their headquarters, and they're juried visually, the actual items are. And then you get through that process, and then you're a member. So it is a guild of all sorts of crafts. It's not just weaving or fiber. And they have large craft fairs twice a year in Asheville. They also have some outlet shops, one in Asheville and the surrounding areas. They also offer you some opportunities for learning, you know, how to sell your work. They have a lot of promotional days. Part of their mission, as you asked, is to educate the public. So it's called the Folk Art Center. It's on the Blue Ridge Parkway in Asheville. There's always at least two craftspeople set up doing demonstrations. They have, throughout the year, they have a Fiber Day, which is actually it's coming up. There's a fashion show and some other demonstrations. They have Clay Day and Wood Day, and that's a weekend then where the members of the guild then would volunteer their time to demonstrate or whatever. They also have some gallery space that you can exhibit in.
So they support professionals as well as, you were saying, inform the public, and we get a symbiotic relationship, if you will, between people respecting these types of handmade crafts, American crafts, as well as supporting you as a professional. So it really works out pretty well.
Yeah, another part of their mission is the heritage aspect. And you can become a member as a craftsperson. You can also become, and I don't know the exact term, but it's if you work in a heritage craft. So if it's weaving traditional coverlets, or if it's making, you know, traditional clay pots, there's also a category for that. And even some of the older crafts, broom making, other things that, you know, keeping the heritage alive, they're very supportive of that as well.
So what about the future? What are your goals? Are you looking at exploring other types of hand weaving? Tell me about what you foresee for the future.
Well, that's a good one. let's see my future. I guess actually while I'm stammering along is because, you know, when you first asked me to talk about all of this, I said it was an evolution. So I don't know exactly what's going to be the future. I love what I'm doing. And I have ideas of what I want to be doing. But I don't set a lot of goals, which maybe I should. I don't know. But it really has been an evolution, and I work at this every day, and I want to be able to continue to do that. I do feel truly blessed and lucky that I am able to do what I love to do, and I guess that will be my goal for the future.
Kathy, thank you so much for having the time to talk to us in this interesting conversation about your work. We really wish you the best of success in your endeavors as an artist and a teacher and a seller of beautiful textiles. For Weavecast, I'm Nancy Smith Kilkenny.
Today's audio essay, When to Weave with the Good Stuff. This is something that came up recently in a class. I was talking to one of the students, and we were discussing when she would be a good enough weaver to use the good yarn in her stash. And I think many of us start weaving, and we believe that we should start with the ugly yarns, the cheap yarns, because we know that we're not going to be perfect weavers right off the bat. And so we have this idea that if we weave with the not good yarn, we won't be wasting it. Here's the problem. If you weave with bad yarn, and I'm going to give an example. Say your dream is to weave with silk. Now, if you start out as a weaver and you think to yourself, wow, silk, it's really expensive. And it is. Personally, I hardly ever weave with silk because of the cost. But if your goal is to weave with silk, and you start out and the first thing you weave with is worsted weight rug yarn, then you're going to learn some things about how to weave with silk. Like you're going to learn what a shed is and you're going to learn how to put yarn on the loom, but you're going to miss out on a lot of the knowledge that you need to weave with the silk. You're not going to know how to deal with skinny yarn. You're not going to know how to deal with slick yarn. And so the learning that you'll be doing will be all about how to weave with rug wool, which is not the yarn you ultimately want to weave with. So you'll be learning things you don't need, and you won't be learning things you do. To continue this example, if you were interested in someday learning how to weave with silk, and if you didn't have just a big pile of silk to practice on, I would suggest buying the best yarn you can afford that is close to that kind of yarn, such as Tencel or Pearl Cotton, or heck, I've woven with crochet cotton from my local hardware store. There are a lot of good, strong yarns that are like the yarn you want to weave with. And I would strongly encourage people to weave with the best yarn they have, even if you're a beginner weaver. Because you know that old saying about you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear? You can't make gorgeous fabric out of junk yarn. Now, in talking to this student, I realized that I myself am guilty of this. I have some yarns that are in my stash. The one ball of Kiviat I bought when I was in Alaska. The really, really fine silk that I bought from Lunatic Fringe. And so I'm going to challenge myself this summer, and I'm going to challenge you, if you're up for it, to go into your stash, find some exquisite yarn that you have been saving and been afraid to weave with because you didn't think you were good enough yet. Find like the good yarn and weave something out of that. That's the Weavecast Summer Challenge. Weave something with the good stuff. I dare you. That's all for this episode. And now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave.